This is only the second time that the third Monday in January, the day honoring Martin Luther King Jr., coincides with the presidential inauguration. It's, of course, the first time it intersects with the inauguration of the first African-American president. So it's a day blanketed in symbols and meaning, a day of impossibility. But where are we really on race relations? A poll for the AP released shortly before the November elections showed a majority of white Americans expressing prejudice towards blacks, and that number was slightly higher than in 2008, despite all those editorials 4 years ago proclaiming Americans moving beyond the bigotry of the past. Well, promise and reality often compete in race relations. Author Michael Eric Dyson writes that whites absolve themselves from producing the murderous passions that finally did kill Dr. King by giving him lesser victories like this holiday. On the other hand, blacks dehumanize King by worshiping him. Whites want King clawless, not the angry black man he really was. Blacks want him flawless, even though he had affairs and depression. Michael Eric Dyson's provocative book is April 4th, 1968, Martin Luther King Jr.'s Death and How It Changed America. And when we spoke in 2008, I asked him to make his case.
The kind of denial of complicity in the very act of murdering Martin Luther King Jr. is critical to the nation saying we can reward him with a holiday by denying our complicity collectively, no individual complicity, but collective complicity, because a lot of people who were white thought it was a good idea to murder Martin Luther King Jr.
You're right. If one man held a gun, millions more propped him up and made it seem good. And you say that what we're forgetting is just how much heat and hate the thought of King could whip up. Tell us more about that, because the caricature of Martin Luther King is of the good, peaceful, accepted black activist, whereas Malcolm X might have been considered by many whites the violent, bad black activist. What's wrong with that memory of Martin Luther King?
Well, it's just not accurate. He wasn't on the top 10 most admired Americans list for a decade. You know, he had been on there. He fell off in 67. No American publisher wanted to publish a book by him. Universities didn't extend lecture invitations to him. He was at the nadir, the low point of his popularity with white America. The second in command of the FBI called him the most dangerous Negro leader in America. I mean, Martin Luther King Jr. was widely reviled. Now, it is true, when Martin Luther King Jr. was joined by Malcolm X and Stokely Carmichael and Floyd McKissick and others who were less likely to restrain black people in their inclinations for violent self-defense, Martin Luther King Jr. looked better. But the reality is he was seen for so much of his career as a pariah. He started that way. Then he ascended to the heights of American acceptance. He won the Nobel Prize, Time Magazine Man of the Year. He gave the I Have a Dream speech, and he was seen as a great Negro leader. But when he began to speak out against the war in Vietnam, he was denigrated. I can't help but think as Lyndon Baines Johnson went on television to pray for peace in the aftermath of Dr. King's death, I can't help but remembering he called him a GDN preacher, the N-word, when Dr. King spoke out against the war in Vietnam.
In fact, we have him speaking against the war. This is a much less remembered speech than the ones we tend to hear this time of year, the I Have Been to a Mountaintop speech. This is April 4th, 1967, a year to the day before he died, speaking really for the first time against the Vietnam War. Let's listen.
As I have walked among the desperate, rejected, and angry young men, I have told them that Molotov cocktails and rifles would not solve their problems. I have tried to offer them my deepest compassion while maintaining my conviction that social change comes most meaningfully through nonviolent action. But they ask, and rightly so, what about Vietnam? They ask if our own nation wasn't using massive doses of violence to solve its problems, to bring about the changes it wanted. Their questions hit home, and I knew that I could never again raise my voice against the violence of the oppressed in the ghettos without having first spoken clearly to the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, my own government.
Michael Eric Dyson, what was happening as he protested the war, poverty, racism that he saw among whites? What was happening to his reputation?
Well, it was taking a beating and a battering. Even John F. Kennedy said having Martin Luther King Jr. come to the White House was like having Karl Marx there. Bobby Kennedy okayed the wiretaps on Martin Luther King Jr., so even ostensible allies among liberals worked against Dr. King's ultimate best interest. So naturally enough, he was depressed. 2 and 3 days, he would sometimes get into the bed and couldn't get out. Vicious hiccups that would assault him, besiege him, overtake him. And then when he got up to speak, flawless. Then he sat back down, more hiccups. He took pills from doctors that ceased to work, so he couldn't sleep. This man, as Andrew Young, his aide, said, had a war on sleep. And yet, despite all of that, he kept on speaking out and kept on speaking against the war in Vietnam, against the premises of white supremacy, social injustice, economic inequality. And by the way, equally a part of that expression was a criticism of black bourgeois culture and the failure of black people to stand up for the interests of vulnerable and poor blacks. So Martin Luther King Jr.'s prophetic articulation cut both ways.
The other problem with this sort of cleaned up image of Dr. Martin Luther King as sort of a serene being is that, you know, young people in particular don't get to learn that there are tortured souls who can also achieve some greatness.
They look at Kurt Cobain and Tupac Shakur, but they could add Martin Luther King Jr., tortured by his failures, grieved by his guilt, enormously motivated by the embarrassment of not being able to live up to the best ideals that he nurtured in his bosom on the one hand, and then resentful that he was being exposed for it on the other. And yet in the midst of that, wanting to work on behalf of a nation to make sure it could get right for all of the faults and flaws that it possessed, and being willing to die for it, and yet the nation wanted to kill him because he wanted to make it better and to hew more closely to the ideas upon which it was founded. That's why celebrating his death is equally as important as celebrating his life. His life is Christmas. April 4, 1968 is Easter. This is crucifixion. This is then potentially resurrection and all of the problems that are attendant upon that.
You were 10 years old when Martin Luther King died.
What 9 years, as a matter of fact.
Nine, even less. Mm-hmm. Did you have an image of him?
Just what I saw on the television that night, the announcement of Dr. King having been shot, I remember that on the local television. I was sitting in front of the TV watching it with my father, who sat behind me, and when they announced that Dr. King had been shot, I had never heard his name, never knew who he was. He went, as if somebody had hit him in the gut. And I became immediately attracted to this figure. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory. And then he turns, walks back into the waiting arms of Ralph Abernathy and the kudos and outstretched arms of Jesse Jackson, having delivered his final words, his benediction, his swan song, unbeknownst to him. And yet it brimmed with premonition, this speech, as most of his speeches at the end did, because how could one not help but be premonitional about a future death that was nearly guaranteed because of the path you pursue, a path, by the way, to make the nation better, to bring it into the circumference of love. That Martin Luther King Jr. is the Martin Luther King Jr. that we have trouble grappling with.
Michael Eric Dyson's book is April 4th, 1968, Martin Luther King Jr.'s Death and How It Changed America. You can read an excerpt at hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Please enjoy this momentous day and then join us to see what this week brings here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software. Find over 200 job openings at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.